What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, the Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iyerinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detective shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, the Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, the Scare on Prime Video, now streaming. Get in, losers. This is the Lady Killers, a Feminine Rage podcast. I'm Jen.
I'm Sammy.
I'm Rocco.
And I'm May. Our podcast is a tribute to the female-identifying killers in horror and more.
Each episode will feature us, your Supreme Court of female murderers, discussing our favorite lady killers, from your Julias and Jennifers to your Carries and Christines.
We'll tell her story, decide if it's good for her horror, and answer the most important question of all: would we die for her?
Join us on Thursdays as we pull on our sweaters, snatch our ice picks, sharpen our scissors, and honor the lady killers who live on the silver screen.
No boys were harmed in the making of this podcast.
Yet.
Greetings and salutations. You've successfully arrived at the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
Greetings, constant listeners. It's Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman. Today, in celebration of the 35th anniversary of Clive Barker's Hellraiser, not to mention David Bruckner's Hellraiser, which you could stream now on Hulu, hashtag not sponsored. Not to mention the fact that it's also spooky season and we're all revisiting our favorite horror movies, we thought we'd unlock one of our older Patreon exclusive episodes from the Derry Private Library. And this is a crate episode from September 2020 that finds losers Mackenzie Gerber, Dan Fleeger, and Mel Castle heading up to the attic where they open the box to hang with some fearsome flesh-eating Cenobites as they solve 1987's Hellraiser. It's a pretty great episode because they all love that movie. Spoiler alert. But as you know, as we do on the Losers Club, we have an analytical lens, and they certainly bring it to that movie. And so I think you're going to like it. But if you enjoy this episode, you could get even more of them by joining our Patreon, www.patreon.com/thebarons. You'd find hours and hours of exclusive content we haven't unlocked, from commentaries of your favorite Stephen King films to our in-depth archival series that goes deep into King's uncollected works to our Dark Tower spinoff series. They're coming back this month. Something on Mr. Callahan, I believe. To our book episodes on new King books like last month's Fairy Tale, last year's Billy Summers, and the list goes on. And by the way, yes, we do lock the new episodes in the Patreon for the new book episodes dedicated to King's new books. But here's the thing, we're on a chronological reread. We can't put them in the main feed. You're all on a path here. You're on the path of the beam on the main feed. Rest assured, when the time comes, we'll get to those books on the main feed here. But for those that want to jump ahead, like us, because look, we want to read the newest books also, so we keep them on the Patreon. But rest assured, they're going to be in the main feed once we get to there chronologically. But for now, if you want them, you got to go to the Barons, www.patreon.com/thebarons. Don't worry, we'll be back with a book episode this month, Wolves of the Cala, our first of three Dark Tower books that we're going to be covering before Santa Claus comes to town. Or you start lighting the lights on the menorah, like I do. Anyway, enjoy this episode. Enjoy the Cenobites, especially Pinhead, Doug Bradley. What a guy. Ashley Lawrence, what a hero. Well, anyway, I've talked enough. I'll see you over long days and pleasant nights.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of hope, all in the name of hope, all in the name of hope.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. And today, we're opening up another crate. And for those uninitiated, the crate houses episodes where the losers get to chat about horror films outside the realm of King. These episodes are determined by members of the Turtle that make requests on the Barrens. And you know, today I opened this giant crate, and it was like one of those awful Christmas gags where you have to keep opening wrapping paper after wrapping paper, and finally ended up with, in the palm of my hand, a beautiful golden puzzle box. That's right, at the request of Zoe Morrison, whose art we just posted on our socials via the Fuck, Marry, Kill episode. I don't know if you two saw that. We just posted her stuff, though. She's requested that we cover Clive Barker's 1987 classic Hellraiser. But before I open the box, I'd like to go around and quickly share who will be joining us from the netherworld. And if you two could briefly tell us in your introduction, your first introduction to Clive Barker's Hellraiser, and also, if you were to be a Cenobite, what special trait might you have? Mel?
Hi. Do we do nicknames?
Sure.
I'm going to do nicknames.
Let's keep it up, yeah.
This is Mel Chattering Cenobite Castle, and my introduction to Hellraiser was that I knew about it for almost my entire life because my parents loved to joke with people that they watched Hellraiser when I was like a 3-week-old infant on their lap, like, and that it did something irreparable to my brain.
Oh, that, wow.
You know, I was too young to comprehend what was going on the screen, but they're both into horror and genre movies, and so it's just sort of been buried in me all this time. It wasn't until I was much older and able to comprehend the movie. I think I first saw it probably in college and just rewatched it for this episode. And it was like a first time watch just because I didn't remember much. But I've always associated it with just something formative for me in terms of being into horror because it's imprinted on my brain. So it's always just held a nice place in my family lore.
Great, great. And then who else do we have on the call today?
Well, this is Dan Butterball Flieger, and I just opened a White Claw, so it's going
to
get
I loved that punctuation to yeah. Butterball.
I didn't want to step on anyone else's record, so
sounded like a chain hooking
itself
into you.
The drinking will be legendary. So my parents are also huge fans of this movie, more so my father, and I remember they rented it, and I would walk through the living room sometimes when they would watch horror movies. Similar thing with The Exorcist, where they were watching a movie, I heard noise, so I ran in, saw what was on the screen. I was probably like 5 or 6, and then just ran out of the room. And from then on, when my dad would tuck me and my brothers in at night, he would quote the movie, and he would often say things like, "Your suffering will be legendary, even in hell," which might actually be from the second movie, but he quotes it all the time. And whenever we had like a puzzle or a riddle, you know, toy, he would act like it was opening the hell dimension. So this one's deeply ingrained in my childhood psyche and trauma.
Oh, wow. That's great. And then to round it off, you have me, Mackenzie, Hellhead Gerber. I've been a big Hellhead
nice.
for a long time. I love the Hellraiser series. I can't remember the first time I saw it, but I definitely watched this in order. And unlike many of the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street films, but I do remember being totally blown away that it, you know, pinheads in like 8 minutes of this movie, because it was just not what I thought it was going to be at all. But yeah, I was a big fan. I think, you know, I'm sure I watched this heavily edited on USA Up All Night or something like that. But I sought out the other films and was pleasantly surprised by the first six. And we're not going to be talking about the rest of this franchise, but there are some good, there's some good eggs in there and there's some bad eggs, and gladly they pretty much go in order. So, but we're going to be talking about the first installment, and let's start talking about that. Oh, you know what? If you were a Cenobite, let's get back to that.
Oh, right.
Mel,
sorry.
If you were a Cenobite, what would your trait, what would you be? What would become you?
Well, I feel like it has to be tied to what would make me sort of suffer the most, right? Or like, I don't know, some sort of sublime wound that became both my pleasure and pain. We already have the Chatterer, but I do feel like my dental phobia is so great that it would be something to do with my mouth, and but I'm not sure what that would be. Maybe just like making my entire lower half of my head like open like a jaw. That sounds Ooh. Pretty cool. And yeah. I would love to have some of the religious ornamentations, like some kind of weird subverted halo or saintly markings. I love that shit. And like a cool robe. I love all the like how it's like weirdly sexual too. So I would love like, I don't know, just markings going on down, like outlining where my organs are and shit. I'm spitballing. What do you guys think?
No, I think all that's great. I think you put more thought into what makes a Cenobite than a lot of people because, you know, in part three, just because someone's holding a video camera, they become a video camera Cenobite, you know? So like, it's slightly loses its way, but I like your take. I think that's more what it would be is, you know, you kind of become your vice or something like that, you know, and then it's flipped on you. Dan, what would you be?
So I would also have an oral one, which is interesting that we're kind of meeting there. I think what would be like one of the chains is a fishing rod on my head, and in front of me would be dangling a chapstick that is just out of reach, and I would be cursed with a dry mouth for the rest of my life. I've been hitting chapstick pretty hard since high school and can't really be calm unless there's one within reach of me. So I think that would be my sort of punishment.
And this Cenobite features on ABC Family's version of Hellraiser coming out.
Yeah, it's a little softer.
Oh,
but damnation nonetheless.
I think I would be just completely contained in some kind of, you know, latex
gimp suit.
Because I think I have like a bit of claustrophobia. I mean, I'm blowing that out of proportion. I don't really think I do have an intense fear of it, but I feel like that is something that would be flipped on me. And then so I would just kind of be like condensed or, you know, like vacuum sealed.
It'd be sick if you only had like one eye visible.
Yeah, like one eye vacuum sealed. And then, but I like the bits of, you know, lead Cenobite and the female Cenobites, you know, like the way that they've got like their flesh pulled back in certain parts, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. So maybe I'm missing out. And then I also thought, you know, one of my major fears is a tornado. So maybe I would just be flying around the room constantly. You can never really get a good look.
The other ones would be like, oh my like. God, we
oh,
have
it's
to
the
bring
tornado Cenobite again. Jesus yeah. Christ.
You're the only kid who ran out of Twister out of the theater screaming into Hellraiser.
Yeah.
I'm going to change my answer slightly because I'm so scared of surgery. I would also want like surgical implements like sticking out of me, like something had disrupted the procedure and I had like walked off the table.
Ooh,
that sort of happens in part two, actually.
Oh, shit. Full disclosure, I've only seen the first Hellraiser.
Oh, hey, you know what? That's okay, because that's really all we're going to be talking about today. Yeah, right.
Yeah, we still have eternity to know your soul, so it's fine.
I think it would be wonderful if some of our brilliant fans, maybe Zoe herself, will take it upon themselves to draw these Cenobite versions of us. I'll probably be doing that in my free time. But because we're already doing this in our free time, let's get back to Hellraiser and let's head down to the basement of Horlicks University.
Christ, I can't see a friggin' thing. Where'd I leave my flashlight? You remember, Doc?
Never mind. Let's put this last name out of here.
So for those of you who haven't listened to a Crate episode, the Horlicks University basement is where we're going to be talking about the background of this film. And Dan, why don't you, do you want to talk about a little bit about the background of this? Do you know anything about this movie?
Yeah, sure. So obviously this comes from the brilliant mind of Clive Barker. It was actually originally in a horror novella called The Hellbound Heart, which was published in November of 1986. It's part of the Night Visions anthology series. And I think that they wrote it knowing that it was going to become a movie because the turnaround was pretty quick, seeing as the film came out in 1987.
Right. They were definitely kind of, I feel like they kept talking about co-writing it, you know, during, not co-writing it, but writing it during the process of beginning to develop the film. Absolutely.
Right. So the actual movie was directed by Clive Barker. You know, he wrote it, obviously the source material, and he wrote the script, the screenplay.
Yeah. And this wasn't his first. Oh God! What was that other film that he did right before this? I'm blanking. If you look it up,
he was really disappointed in other adaptations of his work. Like he hated what someone did with Rawhead Rex and one other film, and he wanted to complete control over his own material to make it into a movie.
Yeah, he just felt like if you're going to get this thing done, you got to do it yourself, unless it's otherwise it's just going to be totally torn apart. And I totally agree with that, you know. And I, not that I've worked in film a lot, but having come from a theater background, if you want to do something, you got to direct it. You've got to kind of be the end all be all if you don't want someone to be cutting apart your script.
But the problem with that, Mac, is that you have no money, right? Like
that's true. And that's why they wanted to do this film on the cheap. I think they had Christopher Figg was a producer, and they wanted initially they kind of sold it as like, we're going to do this in a house with three people. I mean, it essentially is that. I mean, it is very kind of contained to the house for the most part. I believe half of the filming was done, and they kind of started previewing some of it to the producers, and they were like, oh, we can throw some more money at this, because they liked what they saw. And then there were sequences like the creation sequence where Frankenstein kind of puts himself back together in the attic, like that was added after the fact.
They also like said that because they thought it was going to have more appeal than they initially thought, it couldn't be set in the UK anymore, and so that's why they had to like redub people. Yeah, right,
that was, like that was my next question, was is there ever a point in this film where either of you thought this was shot in America? I mean, no, the redubbing's crazy.
I'm a big fan of European horror. There's just like a different feel. You know, I feel like I could watch them on mute and tell if a film is made in Europe, especially if it's a horror movie. And this one definitely captures that. And I guess the UK is a little bit of an outlier. It's not technically Europe for all means and purposes, but it does not feel American, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. You know,
I watched it with a friend who had never seen it, and we spent a lot of time being like, where are we in space and time? I think we settled on New England because we were like, well, the ocean's there, but it's like grimier than the West Coast. So I don't know.
I mean, that would make sense.
Yeah. But I think too, Clive Barker, and I really do think he's a great artist. You know, he does video games. He's a painter. He's a great writer. I think he just has these incredible visions. And I can only imagine that the producers, when they were meeting with him and maybe seeing some of the dailies, they must have been like, this guy's onto something.
Yeah, just that opening scene alone where you have the mysterious setting, the mysterious Frank, mysterious man giving the mysterious box. And then you cut right to like him going into hell, and you have like these like little brief glimpses of the Cenobites, and then essentially tearing him apart and torturing him, and then just the pieces of his face on the, you know what I mean, on the ground. And I think he talked about in the commentary about how he really loved those openings in horror films that were like Jaws and Scanners, that just kind of fucking grabbed you and was like, let's go. And I really love that because I always forget that's how the movie opens, because so much of it, you know, so much of the next hour is just like kind of like a melodrama, you know, just at the house. But I really think that that kind of, that really is like, oh, what are we in for here kind of thing, you know? And I really love that. And so, yeah, if anybody saw the first, you know, 30 minutes to an hour of this film, I bet they were like, oh yeah, this guy's got a vision, you know?
Yeah, and I might have seen it with you, Mac, at the Music Box where Clive Barker spoke. Yeah. This would be back in 2008. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember it was you, me, Caffrey, Rothman was there. And it was nice because he's in the audience and he just seems like a really genuine guy. And he came out after, and when he spoke, he said, you know, I made this movie so long ago on such a small budget. And the fact that you guys were jumping and screaming, he's like, I was literally sitting there crying. I'm just so happy that this movie doesn't endure. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and he has that deep, like, Harvey Fierstein voice.
Yeah, his voice is all but gone on stage now.
And it was just, yeah. But I really, like, I just felt, like, real connection with him. And I thought that was so cool.
It was.
He was wearing, like, acid wash jeans, I remember. But other than that, it was great.
So they made it on what? Like, wasn't it, like, $1 million?
If that. Yeah, it was, like, nothing. It was really low budget. I mean, I never realized that watching it. And then even in the commentary, Clive was talking about hand painting the electric effects of the box at the end, you know, when Kirstie's capturing each of them again. Like, they did that, like, cell by cell, like, old school. And I mean, that's what it looks like, but, like, he said he did that with another guy. I was like, oh, wow, they were really, like, cutting as many corners as they could to make this flick.
They also talk about the corridor that she runs down that seems endless was actually only like 9 feet long or something, and they kept having to force her to look like she was running fast when actually they didn't have a lot of time to shoot her running down this very small corridor. But it worked, like, it really works. It looks fine.
Yeah, yeah. That's and so cool. I think a lot of credit is given to Robin Vigen, who's the cinematographer. And who worked on, like, The Fly 2 and then Nightbreed shortly after this. And I just feel like the way it's lit is great. They know, you know, like, Robin knew how to get the most out of the little they had. And I think that even, like, yeah, that hall sequence, I think you could tell in the very back, there's, you know, there's obviously like a matte painting or something there to make it look longer than it is. But the way they shoot it makes it totally work, I thought. And again, this comes back to my whole thing with, you know, there were a lot of issues with the MPAA on this movie in terms of the violence. But I always feel like when you're censored or when you're only given a specific budget to make something, you've got to get creative. And you have someone like Clive Barker, who's insanely creative and intelligent. And then Bob Keane on special effects. And, you know, these forces kind of came together and had to think outside of the box, pun intended, and made something really, really special, I thought.
Yeah, and having to work within those parameters, because often people tend to be more creative or reactive, and I just think Clive Barker is an artist that can exist in both of those worlds and still give a great product, great art.
Yeah.
And of course, the things that they did end up cutting were sex, right? Like he said, there used to be a little bit more graphic sexual interactions between Frank and Julia, and that he had to take out.
Yeah, he joked on the commentary about how they were the MPAA came back to them and they said that they were allowed to have two more buttock thrusts by Frank in that sex scene with Julia. I mean, it was just like that specific, you know. And this is, you know, this is 87, so they're cutting everything left and right at this time.
Also, especially when it's female pleasure, I think it's been discussed on the podcast before, but the MPAA was really into, if a female was enjoying sex in a movie, that was seen as a little too shocking and would get a higher rating.
They're like, there's sex and then there's sex. Then there's
But you know what I mean? But like Julia is in embracing the sex, and she's, you know, in, you see her face, she's loving it, and it's this pleasure and pain mixed, and I think it just, people just could not handle that, and it's so crazy to look back on that. I mean, it still goes on, but
I do think, you know, I do think this movie was ahead of its time. I think it, you know, obviously it became very popular, but I think that's because people were kind of wanting to see something like this, a little bit more visceral, a little bit more sexy. something that was kind of pushing the boundaries, like, I don't know, like, if you had the box, would you push it to the limits, kind of thing, you know? And so the MPAA, you know, for all they try, I think they by giving us less, it just made us want more. And obviously, we definitely get that in the next one. Maybe not sex, but violence.
Sex in the third one, though.
Oh, yeah. We cannot move on without talking about Christopher Young's score in this film, which I think's one of the best horror scores out there. Some people think it's gaudy or overdone or overused. I think it's great. I love the box theme. I love the main theme. And there was something that said I was watching the Leviathan, which is, there was a documentary on this. It's like 2-hour documentary on the first film and then a 2-hour documentary on the second film. And sadly they don't have, you know, the rights to the footage of the film. So, I mean, well, the dialogue, I guess. They show some scenes, but they don't, you can't hear it. But they were talking about how the movie does take itself seriously. And I think a lot of horror films at the time were just like slasher flicks. And that's great. I mean, there's a time and place for everything. But I do feel like this movie really takes itself seriously. And I feel it's very smart and well done. And I think that the score reflects that hugely. And Christopher Young even said in the doc that his relationship with the film and Clive was able to pull this score out of him. And for better or worse, it's kind of defined his career. And I think that's a great thing to define your career, because I think it's a great score.
I think it all just aligns. It actually reminds me of talking about Hannibal for a different Patreon episode recently, and the aura of high camp or gothic camp that just suffuses the whole show. And I think that's here too. I mean, if you look at the costumes and what the Cenobites actually look like, it's very campy. It's like incredibly over the top. Same with the music. But because it is self-serious, you are compelled to just kind of absorb the whole vibe at once. And I mean, there's just something campy about a guy who's just like fully flayed, also like hitting on his like former girlfriend. It's really leaning into that side of horror that would be ridiculous if it ever let up for a second, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think Hannibal's a good comparison, because there's like a sophistication to the villain. It's not a jump scare. It's more just being in their presence that makes your skin crawl. You know what I mean? Like, you'll shiver, but it doesn't have to attack you kind of like a mindless slasher. It feels like the villain is someone who is way smarter than you could ever comprehend.
Yeah.
Totally. And then also just making literal art out of gore, which is like all this movie is concerned with.
Oh, absolutely. And especially with the Hannibal thing there. Yeah, I think they both do that very, very well.
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, the Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detective shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, the Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, the Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
And speaking of the villains, I think it's time to move to our next section. We like to call your Henrys, your Bullies, your Fluffies.
I know you can.
What are you doing, Henry? What are you doing?
What I should have done a long time ago. Get in there, Wilma. He's telling to call you Billy, you bitch.
Stop it.
Stop it,
Henry!
I'll scream! I'll scream all you want! I'll
help you! Wake up! And this is a section where we're going to be talking about the cast. We've got our heroes of the day. Let's start off with Ashley Lawrence, Kirsty Cotton, who would later be later show up in Hellraiser 2, Warlock 3, The End of Innocence, and and maybe, and no spoilers necessarily, but maybe another Hellraiser film if you stick with the Hellraiser series. I think she, it was funny, she said that she looked like the lead singer of Dokken in this movie, which I wholeheartedly agree. I love this character. I think she's great. I think they do her justice in the next film as well. But what do y'all think, Mel?
Do you guys know if this comparison is really popular and I'm just like late to the game? But this, her look and the fact that this movie came out in 87, it just struck me as a completely topsy-turvy version of Labyrinth. Like, she looks like Jennifer Connelly's character looks in Labyrinth, and the practical effects and the corridor and all this stuff, it just reminded me of nothing else so much as that, in like a way that it made it nightmarish. I like, is that something that people say?
I can see it. I don't know if I've heard that, but that's a good observation, because there is something almost of this, you're sort of, she's moving on and kind of leaving her innocence behind, you know, like she's getting hit on. She's having to kind of deal with this all on her own. I think that's a good comparison.
Even maybe her outfits, which is just, you know, the 80s. But like, I love her. I want to kind of investigate this feeling that I have that Hellraiser is in some ways actually like a pretty feminist film, or at least delves into like how sex, it becomes the primary way that women interact with the world, and how that is awful, and like, and how male pleasure begins to dominate how we get what we want or move ahead. And I think Kirsty has a lot of agency in this film. I really love her. To me, she almost feels like the only real character amidst like all these other strange people.
And I love that, though. I love how she's just like, you know, the only voice of reason among all these adults that are just fucking everything up, you know, especially her father. That's funny.
Clive Barker.
No, go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, sir. No, I was going to say, because I remember listening to Loveline back in middle school, and he said that when he was young, and, you know, he's a homosexual man, but he dated older women when he was in his teens. And I think if you combine that exposure to older, you know, perhaps having a better understanding of writing female characters than a lot of you know, other 80s horror writers or directors had. He was a constant guest on Loveline, too. And I love hearing his voice. Again, it's got that very, like, gravelly. But he always has interesting stories to tell. And he just seems like such a nice guy that you could just, you know, he could fit in any situation.
Well, you know, something funny about the Labyrinth parallel is he's a big Dario Argento fan. Like that sequence with the sheet coming on the bed, the dream sequence where the sheet kind of like doused in blood and the feathers are all over the place and stuff like that was very Argento, he said. And Jennifer Connelly was in Phenomena, and so maybe he's pulling a little
where she can talk to bugs.
Yeah, where she can talk to bugs, and I think that maybe there's a little connection there. I really like that Labyrinth pull, though. I've never heard that before, Mel. If you've seen that on the internet, you have to shoot me any other thoughts.
But it's just so weird. They came out so close together. I thought that maybe it would just be a natural connection. But I love Kirsty. I think that Ashley Lawrence does the best that she can with like the weird script that she's given, and she really sells it. And she also gets a little opportunity for her own romance, which I think like can be read as a sort of tossed off thing. But what I view it as is just like, wow, let's get one glimmer of like what a healthy consensual relationship might look like amidst all of this like tumultuous, hellish abuse and seduction.
Yeah. And I know that like the Steve, the love interest played by Robert Hines, when we'll talk about him in 2 seconds, that he was kind of, he was not happy. Well, I guess we could just move to Steve right now because we're going to talk about it. He was not super happy with his character. And it wasn't that he felt like, I just think he felt like he had nothing to do, but that was the point. You know, they purposely wrote that character, they said, as kind of like Kirstie's foil, like in terms of just, they wanted Kirsty to be the stronger character, which is totally the way that it goes in the film. But if, sadly, Steve doesn't do fucking anything in this movie. He shows up at the end. I know, but even when he shows up at the end, like she basically saves him, which I think is really cool. And I feel like nobody talks about that a whole lot, because I feel like this franchise gets, I wouldn't say overlooked, but I think that because of the melodramatic aspects of the Frank-Julia relationship, I think this first film kind of gets glossed over sometimes when they talk about this franchise. I think they go right to two. But I think that there's so much to pull from this one. I feel like, you know, it, like you were saying, just with the, from the feminist outlook of it, period. I think, yeah, it just gets totally glossed over. But
if you think about every interaction that Julia has, the men almost all are shown to like pretty much get on the brink of rape with her. And it's like very important, I think, that they show Steve as a sort of passive, like the scene where they kiss is there's a lot of like lead up where they're kind of like flirting and pretty much like just asking each other, like, is this what you want? And before they kiss, and it's like a very sort of like chaste kiss even after all that.
Yeah.
But there's no threat of the same kind of rape.
Yeah, but, and I think that ties into with Julia too. There's, I mean, the larger, obviously there's a lot of S&M influence in the costuming, but also the dichotomy between pain and pleasure. And, you know, Julia kind of making herself vulnerable, but when in fact she's the one that's really controlling the situation, and, you know, she's the one that's going to dominate the men ultimately. Yeah. I just think it's great how that theme is kind of woven throughout the entire film and a little bit further into the series, but eventually it kind of drops off. It just becomes
just a little bit.
Well, Julia, we should talk about Julia. She's really complicated, because I agree that she does kill these men and does wield agency in that way, but she's doing it for, you know, her Skella boyfriend, and he never kind of releases control of her. She never really thinks for herself. She's always just wanting to fuck her Skella boyfriend.
I love the Skella
boyfriend. Yeah, but I think she is getting off on it too. I think she does enjoy it to an extent. And I think also the fact that they cast, you know, a woman that was in her late 30s as the villain in a movie, you know, you don't see that as often back then. It would always be, you know, a younger girl cast in that part. But, you know, Claire Higgins, you know, she's been around, been in a few movies. I think it was a great choice to put her in that position.
Yeah. And
her hair is awful.
But it was the 80s. Some things are just time stamped, you know, and that is just one of the biggest ones.
But I think I agree, Dan, in that maybe it was like her consent in this is that like she does actively enjoy the very like BDSM nature of their relationship.
Yeah, and there's a lot of power shifting too with her and Frank, because in the beginning, isn't he's sort of like pleading with her and begging, and I think she kind of eventually does submit to him, but I think that goes to the larger kind of S&M themes in this movie too.
Let's just note, like, I'm an avowed admitted monster fucker, but like Frank is a little too gnarly even for me.
Whoa. Like, really?
He is just covered in mucus always.
Yeah.
And every time he has a transformation, you think it's gonna get better, and it's like, oh no, he's still just slimy.
Hey, if I was Julia, you know, I'd have to really be good at keeping my eyes shut during those little flirtations with Frank. It's absolutely disgusting. Claire Higgins, man, knocks it out of the park in this. She's so good and so evil, you know. But also, I do like that power dynamic between the two of them. Like you're saying, Dan, I do think there's a total shift back and forth. You know, he desperately needs her to kill for him, but then, even in the end, she's just kind of like, he's gone past it, you know, like she was in it for like the best sex and love of her life, Frank, but Frank's like kind of like been there, done that. He's gotten the box and he needs her, but doesn't need her for that. He wants more. Even after going to hell and suffering all this stuff, he's not complacent, you know, and he ends up killing her. But I think that, Claire Higgins is a great choice. And I'd be remiss if I did not mention that she's also in Doctor Who as one of the Sisterhood of Karn.
There you go.
And she helps my favorite doctor, number 8, aka Paul McGann, regenerate into, spoiler alert, another doctor. Before we move on to our villains of the piece, though, we got to talk about Larry Cotton, aka Andrew Robinson, who is the killer from Dirty Harry. Have you guys both seen Dirty Harry?
I have not.
Oh, man. Yes, do yourself a favor.
I don't remember him being in it, though. It's been
he
so long.
He's the serial killer. He's the killer in Dirty Harry, and he is awesome in that movie. He is so unhinged and bizarre and just great performance, just off-putting.
Well, his flip in this is great, too,
absolutely.
From kind of like nebbishy husband to Frank wearing husband's skin.
Yeah. He's just, the range is incredible there. And I guess he was also pretty much like probably one of the most, I guess he had the most film background at this point.
He was their get.
Right. And like, I think that there was some trouble on the set just because, you know, when you have like an experienced actor on a set and you have a first time director, there's always going to be like butting heads. But for the most part, I think that they both really respected each other. And then in this doc that I'm watching right now, he says great things about Clive Barker and he was really interested in his work and was really excited to be on it. And it's cool to see they've got everybody on this doc, by the way. Which I think you can watch. I think the first part's available on YouTube. It used to be available on Shudder. Now the second part's only available.
Only part two is on Shudder. I did watch them when they came out.
Yeah.
And it was great. I just dedicated a Saturday to it.
Yeah. And they've got everybody on there. But yeah, Andrew Robinson, if you like him, he's also in Child's Play 3. No, he's in a bunch of movies.
Here's a question. For the Hellheads. Is it understood or not, or like not a thing that he knows or suspects that his wife has slept with his brother? Like, it seems like at the beginning when they're kind of like, but maybe we can like make it work here, that there's sort of an acknowledgement of a betrayal in the past, but I'm not sure if it's as explicit as like he knows.
I don't know.
I always took it as, so I took it as Julia kind of preying on a weak guy. Or just, you know, it's not like she faked it to marry him. I think that she's always been Julia, and anyone that would be with her would kind of understand that. So I think the fact that she was cheating on him, it's not the biggest surprise in the world for that relationship. That's kind of how I always took it.
But maybe he doesn't know it was with Frank.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the part that's like she's enjoying that. That's kind of what adds that extra titillation to her and gives her a little more power in that relationship, the fact that he doesn't know. And how damaging it is. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if he knew about Frank, but I think that he's definitely aware that she's not happy. She might be seeing some other gentleman nice. Outside of the walls of the home.
But even he is not immune to almost raping her. Like, she really protests, you know, when Frank is about to kill him and he's on top of her and it sounds like she's protesting the sex. Like, it takes him a while to stop.
Yeah, but Mel gets really mad. But Mel, he says, you know, like, she, 1 minute you're all over me and the next, like, that's an excuse.
Please make it clear to our listeners that you're joking.
I think that all of these guys, I mean, even down to like the people moving the stuff in the place, you know, are practically like,
oh, yeah, of course,
oogling they're Julia and oogling Kirsty. Which is funny. I read that Oliver Parker is one of the movers. He was initially up to be Pinhead. It was going to be between Doug Bradley and him. And they kind of debated it just because of the fact of the how long it would take to get into the makeup. Because
right.
I think they drew
straws. Doug Bradley says he, well, I don't know if they literally drew straws, but Doug Bradley says he drew the short straw. Like, he didn't want to do it either.
Yeah, because, I mean, and if you go back and think about it, he's only in about the same as the mover, probably. He's like a little bit more, maybe. 8 minutes of the movie. You're practically covered and totally covered in makeup and all this stuff, you know? And like Clive Barker said, when Pinhead walked on the set, he said he wished he could have been like, oh, this is like groundbreaking and amazing. But he was kind of like, this looks really silly. And you got to think on set, standing there with those Cenobites and the way that Robin lights that room, just completely well lit. You got to think, oh, this kind of looks goofy, you know, but it's one of those weird things that never lets up. And all those elements come together. And I think it just weirdly works.
Do you think the guy who ended up playing the mover is like hitting himself over?
No, because Oliver Parker,
autograph.
Oliver Parker actually went on to become a director. I mean, he directed Lawrence Fishburne's Othello. He did An Ideal Husband.
You mean Kenneth Branagh's Othello?
Yeah.
William Shakespeare's Othello.
Also, he was Peliquin in Nightbreed. If you didn't see Nightbreed, this is some other Nightbreed connections in this, as the actors were obviously friends of Clive's and continued on in his next film. Let's talk about Frank. We've kind of skirted him a little bit. This is the character that I want to talk about the most because it's so interesting. You've got Sean, he's played by four different people, essentially. You've got Sean Chapman as human Frank. You've got Andrew Robinson then playing Frank later on in the movie with the Larry skin on. You've got Frank the Monster, who was portrayed by Oliver Smith in the skin outfit and everything. And then you had an unknown American actor doing the voice. And I think it's interesting because you have four different actors portraying him. And I like the idea that Frank has been essentially torn apart at the beginning of this film and he's being pieced back together. So you have these four actors kind of using their performances to kind of piece this monster together. And I kind of think that really weirdly works because I know some people are put off by the dub, but to me, the dubbing aspect just made it feel like an Argento film, you know? And I really love that aesthetic.
Also, the voice is great. It's like deep and scary.
It is. I think Frank is so scary. I think that is one of the things that surprised me the most in this was coming into it. You know, you think it's just going to be Cenobites, especially from that first sequence in the very beginning of the movie where they show them.
Right
out the gate, they show the villains. But then most of the movie is just Frank and Julia killing people. And yeah, I can't wait till we get to the scares because I think that Frank is just pretty terrifying. I think he's a great...
Just to add another... Yeah, exponential layer. And in the second movie, Frank pretends to be a different character.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have four people coming together to represent a man who's then playing a different character later in the series.
Just really good. Love Frank.
And I know they cast Oliver Smith partially because he was the skinniest guy they could find because they needed him to like look natural in the skin suits.
Speaking of skinny guys, I think it's time to... move to our Cenobites, and we've got one of the smallest guys playing one of the biggest Cenobites, Butterball, Simon Bamford. And we'll run through these characters because obviously they just kind of stand around in this movie at least. But Simon Bamford, what a delight on these documentaries too. He also played Onaka in Nightbreed and would show up again in Hellraiser 2. You know, it's funny that some of the actors that portrayed these Cenobites really were only in Hellraiser 1 and 2. But I guess when you think about it, some of these Cenobites don't really pop up in the future films, which is very sad, but for a couple. What did anybody have anything special to say about Butter?
Well, who's,
I
want to know
the toy.
I want to know who everyone's favorite Cenobite is of the four.
Oh. Yeah,
I've always been partial to Pinhead. I've been really into that character for so long, and I had action figures of several of them, and I lost them when moving. But I mean, I had action figures from the fourth film also, so that's how deep into this mythology I got.
Hey, I love the fourth movie. Mel, who's your favorite Cenobite?
Oh, I think it's got to be the Chatterer. I just think that they're so scary and like. The moment where we're going into scariest scenes, but I think with everything that the Chatterer does is super effective, and the fact that they never talk. And then second place, I think, would go to the female Cenobite, who I love the like open vocal cords and the hissing voice. Love Pinhead, gotta love him, but I think him and Butterball just don't do as much for me.
Yeah,
I like the chattering Cenobite when he sticks his fingers and pierced his mouth. That always scared me. And if you watch wrestling, Mankind, Mick Foley, his finishing move was the mandible claw, and it's sort of inspired because he uses the same fingers to put them in your mouth and like pinch your mouth as his finishing move. Ooh. Creepy stuff.
Yeah, my favorite's definitely the Chatterer. I just from the design alone, and I like the idea that you've got, you know, these two Cenobites that are doing the talking, and then you've got these other that are just like beyond, you know. And I love that sequence. It's really hilarious when when they all show up at the end to confront Frank, and the chatterer just kind of like pushes Frank into the room more. Like, you know, when he's in Larry's skin, he's just kind of like, get in there. It's like, cracks me up. Cracks me up. Love the chatterer.
Yeah, he seems like he's kind of the muscle. You know, he's like the enforcer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, like grab him. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah.
Well, isn't the lore, I mean, you guys know more about the lore than I do, but I was under the impression reading a little bit that in the original version of these characters, like, they're not from hell. They just go to other dimensions and like are so twisted by their like weird torture pasts, and they've become these monsters, but they're not actually like from a religious hell.
The series eventually just calls it hell.
Right.
But in the second movie, they really get more into the background of this realm that they exist in, and they worship Leviathan, who is this weird floating diamond. You don't know if he's in it,
it's so weird
controlling it. It's, but I like it that it's almost incomprehensible, but obviously
kind of like that dragon at the end.
Yeah. That's such
we talked about on Halloween is, I think someone was, we were talking about doing the Hellraiser series at one point, and I said something along the lines of it actually not being hell, and I got so much shit for it, but thank you for bringing that up, because it's really not. I don't think it was originally supposed
to be. It's
not. It's just like, you know, like one person's hell is another person's heaven kind of thing, and I think they're just these, they've kind of just been dubbed demons because people didn't know how to explain it any other way, but they're really just kind of from this weird dimension where pain is pleasure, you know?
Well, my head canon is it's the same place that the people in Event Horizon go.
I love that movie, and that's a similar reason. And I always say, like, this reminds me the most of Hellraiser, because it's not a Judeo-Christian hell, right? Where there's no reason that would be truer than any of these. But there's parallels of, like, okay, there's going to be a big boss in this place of suffering. And can I jump into it kind of hits a few categories. It is a little bit scariest. But I remember watching this movie with my friend once. We were watching the World Cup, and we were stoned and sitting on beanbags. And my friend just started getting obsessed with the line where they're like, what are you? And the lead Cenobite, Pinhead, says, we are explorers in the furthest regions of experience, demons to some, angels to others. That idea that they're not even traditionally one way or the other, but they're just seeking experience at like the furthest comprehensible level. And I was so stoned. I was just like, why did you say that to me right now? It's freaking me out.
You're like, fuck you. That is what's scary about it. It reminds me of like Werner Herzog and Grizzly Man being like, you know, the neutrality of nature is what's scary. Like, they don't, they just don't care. Like, they're not evil, but they're going to do what they're going to do if you open that fucking box. Like,
And our ideas that we would try to understand, it wouldn't even work, you know? And it's,
well, that's what,
like, there's something we said, like the Lovecraft of like, oh, you can't comprehend it. But I actually think them saying that, you're like, no, they're explaining to us why we can't comprehend it. And that's what's scary.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think the ambivalence of these characters is really frightening. Like, you can't reason with them because they're not there to be reasoned with. Like, you open the box, we came. That's it. Done. Like, you're now going to be tortured.
But you can
and all
play
stuff,
by
you know?
their logic, trade a life for yours, and then I guess seal them back in the box when they renege on the deal.
Rules. They definitely renege on that deal that they make with her. But I think that is what makes them so scary. And Pinhead, or credited as lead Cenobite in this movie, because I don't think they didn't have the nickname yet, which is crazy to me. How did they not have that nickname right when they first saw him, you know? But he is played by Doug Bradley, and I just felt like I got to mention that he's in Hellraiser 1-8, and it's one of those roles. Justin says this all the time, my brother Justin, and you can't replace Doug Bradley, and that's tough because I do feel like this is a character. This isn't necessarily like Freddy, but there's a cadence and a presence that Doug Bradley brings to the role over those 8 films, and some of these movies he's in like less than this movie, but I just feel like it is pretty iconic, and it's really hard to to put someone else in that role. I think he does such a good job selling those like over the top lines and balancing this quartet. Is there any other comments on these Cenobites before we move to our next category?
Can I make a comment on the Hellbound Heart? So he's not really a pinhead in the book. They don't really have a name for them, but it's funny. So in the book, they actually speak with like children's voices. They're higher pitched and they smell like vanilla. Yeah, but they smell like vanilla and there's like a sense of rot underneath the vanilla, which I think is great. And they're really not in there a lot. I mean, even like the movie, you know, they sort of just show up as this force of nature and they have this weird dignity to them that's just so creepy. I think they call them the Hell Priest in the comics.
Yes.
There's never like a pinhead.
I like that Clive says he wanted to project a sense of, you know, a lot of intellect onto the lead Cenobite, and that was like a new sort of thing for a really creepy villain character, that usually they were just kind of dumb and lumbering and like going after you, or like Freddy, they were cracking jokes and just being like kind of punny. And this one was like, no nonsense, I'm very smart and I want one thing from you and it is your suffering, was like kind of a new deal. I also read in my extensive Wikipediaing that the comic series is like potentially pairing Kirstie and Pinhead romantically, and all I have to say is I would like to see it.
Oh, interesting.
you stan.
I have not heard that. That's very, very interesting, though.
Well, and we had a fellow loser, Jen, admitted when we were planning this episode that she has a crush on Pinhead. So, no, like, we're not alone in our affinities.
No. Oh, I mean, I have a crush on Pinhead. I mean, I'm reading the Bestiary comics right now. I don't have them all, but that is whetting my appetite, that pairing.
Yeah, I think I got Dan an issue or a trade or something of Hellraiser, and he was kind of like, oh, this isn't really my thing, which surprises me because he's so into Nightbreed. But I think he ended,
Dan Caffrey, just
to
clarify.
Ended up reading it and liking it. okay, well, I'm sure we're going to keep talking about the Cenobites and the horrific things they do as we continue. But right now we're going to talk about stuff we don't like in a section we call Shit for Brains.
Same old Henry, afraid of your own shadow. You know what, Henry? You're a regular barnyard exhibit. Sheep's eyes, chicken guts, piggy friends, and shit for brains.
Look, it's a film of its time, people. it's very stuck in the 80s. If there's any, I would say if there's anything that I could say outright that I didn't like about it, personally, especially after watching the rest of these, is the idea of like the derelict that becomes like the weird dragon thing at the end, because I didn't think you needed it. Like, I like the idea of that character being the man in the beginning who's kind of selling the box to people, and they bring that back in a remake way down the line, or not a remake but a weird awful version they kind of just threw out there to keep the rights. But I don't like that concept, and I didn't like the dragon. I thought it was just like, what the fuck is this? You don't need it. Like, I feel like the Cenobites are enough, you know? What do you guys think?
I think that you have to watch this movie with context, because if you don't, it's actually a bad movie. Like, maybe unpopular opinion, but like, you know, if you go in with nothing other than I'm going to watch a horror movie today in 2020, it's not a good movie. Like, the writing isn't great. The acting is whatever. The budget is clearly like uneven in places. The practical effects are sometimes great, also uneven in other places. But when you have the context and when you sort of like surrender to the experience, it's like nothing else, especially of its time. Yeah. So I mean, I think because it kind of demands that of the watcher, it can be difficult. Like, I felt kind of bad watching it with my friend who had never seen it, because I was like, ah, yes, like this was made in the 80s with $1 million.
Yeah.
And I agree about I agree about the derelict, and I think like the puzzle box opening and closing is like exoticizing and racist. Like, of course they're going to put it in this like vaguely Eastern setting, like, yeah, give it to like this white man. And yeah, the guy is like weird and like cast as homeless and disgusting by virtue of that fact, and then becomes a dragon, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. I would actually be willing to forgive that were it not for like the other ass. Like, I think it's in keeping with the weird nature of the film that like there would be this other force that protects the box and just turns into a weird dragon at the end.
Yeah.
But I just yeah, do see- think it's so dreamy, and you have to like let it be dreamy, like, or you're gonna have a bad time.
Yeah, the ethereal nature of it, I think it all, the sum total somehow becomes better than the individual elements.
Right.
And I think I really like low budget cinema. So the fact that they could do this, like, I honestly would rather watch this than any of the Marvel movies. You know, when I see $300 million on a special effects budget, and I'm like, nobody could write an interesting story. Whereas this to me is a very, I was raised Catholic, and the idea of hell is such a powerful concept of suffering forever. So, like, slasher movies never really bothered me, but this movie, for some reason, always gets under my skin, and it's just that concept of just being in, not just pain, but agony for eternity while these people devour your soul. It just was so terrifying.
Yeah.
So I think it holds up pretty good for, you know, it definitely is of its time, and some of the effects are a little cheesy, but I'd rather see, you know, the hand-drawn or practical effects, even the end. I don't think it should have ended with the demon, you know, whatever.
No,
I think that's kind of cheesy, but I do remember from Leviathan, though, that it's interesting that the props guy had like what, $500, so he went out and bought like a horse skeleton and a deer skeleton and like shoved the hook, he like put the horns through the hole, he basically created a creature that doesn't exist. And when you look at how, I mean, for $500 to create that effect, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, they used what they had to, you know. I agree with you both on the front that it's kind of hard to watch it now if you don't have the context or go into it with some kind of knowing, or like whenever I show, because this is one of my favorite flicks, and I think it's because when I watched this at the time in my life, I was very, you know, I hadn't seen all the shit we've seen over the last, you know, 20 years. You know what I mean? So this wasn't too far off.
You were innocent and
uncorrupted. Yeah, and it wasn't too far off from you know, the special effects of where I was at in like the early 90s, probably. You know, I mean, this is only like so many years after that. I think that for me, it's hard to watch this with people. Like, I've tried to show this to people over the years, and I feel like there's a lot of setup that has to go into it. It's kind of like having people watch the original King
Kong.
You gotta
have a PowerPoint.
Saying like, this was amazing at the time, and it was like groundbreaking and this and that, and they watch it and they're like, oh yeah, I guess I could see that. But you have to watch it with through the lens of which, and with this movie, not only do you have to watch it through the lens of I'm watching a late 80s horror film, you have to also watch it through the lens of, you know, they had no money.
You know, right,
like,
right.
Like, but it's the idea, I think, that's attractive.
I asked Justin, I think, over text in our group text, like, what do you like? Like, I want to know what other people like about this movie. And he said, you know, it's bold, it's kinky, and he likes the amateurish quality. It reminds me of, like, people who are, like amateur porn almost, where it's like, yeah, I mean, it's just more honest. It's just more raw. Like, it's just, like, that's actually part of the appeal.
It feels less scripted, and it feels like the people in it are actually experiencing it versus just going through it, you know.
Yeah, and
for this and amateur porn.
this is our plug for amateur pornography.
Yeah, go out there and make yourself a star. No, but I think the context is important too, in that, like, there's definitely movies where I'll recommend to people, and there's some that I won't. And this is like, you know, this is a personal movie for me. I know it's not going to go, you know, have the same impact because I watched it at a period of my life, you know, when I was like developing. But it's the same with like playlists. Like, if I go to a party, there's a different playlist I'll put on for one group of people versus another. Even if I like all the songs involved, I understand that the audience may not. So I don't take it to, you know, different strokes, different folks kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know that if you talk to someone who can appreciate the art of Hellraiser, you've got a friend.
Exactly.
No, I remember.
But there's definitely there's other things to connect on too. That's the thing is like if you know you can't put a square peg in a round hole, and there's like a ton of films that I love that I know other people don't, and vice versa. So yeah, I wouldn't recommend this for everyone. But I do think seeing how it holds up, you know, almost 40 years later, it's pretty incredible. And that's going back to Clive Barker crying. I think that's it was cool to him to see that his art had endured across a different generation than the one he intended it for.
Yeah, and what's funny about that screening, Dan, is I brought my girlfriend at the time to see it for her first time. And I remember asking her after the movie what she thought. And she was like, she said she didn't love it, but she understood why people were so like enamored with it. And then we got into like a really heavy discussion about the film itself. And I think that if she hadn't seen it in that setting with those fans, with Clive Barker that would speak about it afterward, I just feel like she wouldn't have liked it at all, or there wouldn't have been any kind of, you know, the people can just like write this movie off in a heartbeat. You have to be open to it, and you have to welcome its strangeness and its rawness into you if you want to get anything from it. And I think that it does.
Take the rawness into you.
I think it does deliver.
It's like a crash course of context.
I think it does. You get that rawness in you. I think it does deliver the goods.
I got to say, one of our friends took a first date to see Cannibal Holocaust at the Music Box.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
There was not a second date.
Honey, no.
I know. As soon as everyone I tell that to, they're like, what? I was like, exactly. Everyone was like, what are you doing?
I'm actually holding. So Dan and I both have versions of the puzzle box at our homesteads.
The Lament configuration.
The Lament configuration, and I'm holding it right now.
Yeah, because when we were zooming at the beginning of quarantine, we had some friends, you know, doing a group chat, and me and Mac were exchanging the box into our cameras to each other.
That's how ridiculous we are.
I know. Scary thing is I don't sleep with it in my room.
Before we move into the scariest moments, really quickly, because there's not really a section for this, I think this, if they did a Hellraiser movie that was kind of like someone opens the box on a Zoom meeting, do you know what I mean? Like, that would be so cool. Or they did something like the box, like I always had this idea where someone finds the opening of the trailer of the film is just going to like a building, to like a building's daycare, and amongst all these toys in this little daycare center room, the box is there, and that's just kind of like a teaser. But like, what if like a child opened up the box?
Mac, you know, write just like, it. I mean, I know. Aren't they rebooting it for HBO?
I really should. Okay, well, before I don't know if you guys have any ideas for a Hellraiser movie, just stew on that and maybe bring it up.
I mean, I think Hellraiser. The kid stuff is I like the kinkiness. I wouldn't want to lose that. Like, I need there to be people that are sexually active involved with the box, but
yeah, that's very true.
The
I guess.
Box could end but, up anywhere.
Yeah.
Hellraiser : OnlyFans.
I think the problem with the series, and now since we're still talking about stuff we don't like, not to get too involved with the rest of the movies, is that I think they start mistaking it for like a bad softcore porn entry situation where it becomes, they take the sexual aspect of it and they kind of just make it a little bit more like about that. And I'm like, that doesn't interest me.
I guess
as
how
much.
So? Because the first movie is suffused with sex. It is like almost entirely about sex. So how I see it as
I guess it's kind of like late night Showtime movie. But Hellraiser. It's just not done as it's not done.
It's just worse. Okay.
Yeah, it's just worse. Yeah, it's just worse. Yeah.
The third one has a lot more nudity because it's kind of like a dance club where there's like strippers. But the fourth movie, and you know, I know, not a major spoiler, but you find a Cenobite that came from the 1700s, Angelique.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She's this beautiful woman. And instead of pain, the Hell Dimension would use seduction as their means
torturing people. No, because they're supposed to be the same thing. That's what the Sublime means. Okay,
But it's great because Pinhead and her go back and forth, and he's like, oh, things have changed since you've been around. And it's interesting.
If you're looking for continuity, Mel. This franchise is all over the place.
It ends up on a spaceship, so there you go.
I mean, I sort of love that.
But. Yeah, the first four, I feel like the first four are, you can watch, I think one, two, and four more so, but three, there are elements of three that obviously connect with two and four. So I think if you're watching it for continuity's sake, four is kind of it. But they do kind of always add or change a little bit of the lore every time, you know? So you're kind of just open to, okay, well, this is this person's interpretation of it, whatever. But there isn't just one end-all be-all. And I don't think there is for the box, but...
I like continuity. And I guess, yeah. I guess to clarify too, I think when I say the movie is suffused with sex, it like definitely is, but it also is conflating sex and power and gore and like making them all the same thing, which is part of its appeal. And so I can see how if it devolves into like just kind of titillating sex without that element of
like part three, I love it, but it's just fun sex. It's not, there's not a lot of deeper meaning.
But I just think perhaps that it's a hard, you know, line to walk with. If you have someone that really, really gifted, they can do that really well. But if you give it to someone that doesn't really know what they're doing, it can just really easily become kind of like, why am I watching this? This is just kind of gross and just kind of like total like D movie, you know? Okay, enough with the stuff we don't like. Let's say, because I do actually like to, let's get to our next category where we talk about the scariest moments called Under the Stairs.
It's easier if I just, I'll show you, I think. Come on down.
What's this?
So Clive Barker said that there weren't, quote, enough, quote, not enough boo scares or jump scares. So they had to add some of those things in this movie. And I don't think that those are the things that, even though there's a pretty good jump scare with the maggots corpse that kind of comes out of nowhere on Kirsty. But I do feel
that?
Like,
is that just like one of the guys that
that's
died?
One of the guys, yeah. Like she's been hiding. That's the funny thing to me. Apparently she's been hiding the corpses of these guys in the empty room. Doesn't that place not smell like like death? You know?
Well, like, no, because they've been like desiccated. Mummies don't smell.
I don't know, but all those maggots and just rolling around.
If they sucked
like
the life essence out.
Hmm. Oh, that's true. There are maggots, so there's some rot. Yeah, that's a bad. You can tell they added it.
Yeah, exactly. But let's just go around in a circle and hit on some of our favorite scariest moments.
Triangle.
Who wants to kick it off?
I'll
Dan.
Say one.
Yeah.
I think whenever the bell tolls is very scary to me.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where you see the bricks and then the color switches to negative. So the black, I'm trying to think if it's black turning to white or white turning to black, but through the creases, you know, where the mortar is on the bricks, smoke starts pouring in. And I just think that's such a cool shot. It's such a simple effect, but it's very scary. The same with the chains. You know, the fact that you don't really know where they're coming from, they just fly in, and obviously they were filmed in reverse, or, you know, filmed and then played in reverse. I think the chains are a very scary element, and just the sound of, like, wet chains that's kind of always in the background when the Cenobites arrive.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple, but it's very effective.
No, I agree. I love how, like, when they show up, the logic of the room falls away, and it's almost like you're in just a dark warehouse or something. You don't know where it ends, you know? And I love that. Something that's just scared me, it was just unsettling, so off-putting, is that sequence when Julia is in the attic and like the weird half-formed baby Frank just kind of hobbles really quickly after her. And I just had one of those moments where like I put myself in her shoes and I was just like, oh, if I saw that thing hobbling towards me, I'd probably just like freeze out of and die of fright or something, because it's so weird. That stuck with me for years. That always really creeped me out. I love the way that Frank just kind of slowly comes back from the heartbeat underneath the floor, and just his whole thing is really creepy to me. I think most of my scares are with Frank, you know.
For sure. Frank is disgusting.
Yeah. What about
I think I guess to go with along with Dan's kind of like aesthetic, the rotating wood pillar that being it's like a wet slapping like rotating noise. It reminds me of like a Nine Inch Nails video.
very much. It's like closer.
And it's again, and it's like so amateurish. Like it's just like, yeah, they just filmed this thing like, but that almost makes it more real. Like you can actually kind of like get the full sensory brunt of it in your face, and it's, you know, they did something horrible on that thing. There's bits of flesh hanging from it, like, so I think just the way they put together the impression of the hell warehouse that you mentioned is so well done with so little. I think also Frank's deterioration into kind of like, he is now, I mean, he's not really a Cenobite, but he is someone whose pursuit of feeling has rendered him inhuman, and that also means that he is like going after Kirsty in this incestuous way. And you can tell me if I'm misreading this, but you know, after he says come to daddy to her and she kind of goes for her wandering out on the street and is like remembering it, it almost seemed like it was an older trauma, like maybe Frank had always been creepy to her or had maybe molested her before. Like he just like has this vibe, and I found that so creepy.
Yeah, I think you nailed it.
Yeah, I definitely picked up on that too this time around as well. Just there's something has probably happened there before, which is even more disturbing. I think anytime Frank's on the screen, I'm just like put off. Especially when he digs his fingers into the victims, like in their throats and stuff, like that is so disgusting. I mean, there's some really, really gross, raw visuals that just, I think they do really well. And, you know, hats off to to the special effects department on that front for Bob Keane. They just did such a good job with that. I think also, I love that scene when Frank is in the closet. And he starts slowly walking towards them while they're like, well, you know, Larry's trying to like get it on with Julia. I that is terrifying to me, because just the idea of like he's right there, he's in the same room, and just like he just never knows at all. But he was there, he was so close to like killing him. Yeah, and he's just his look in that scene where he's at that point he's like kind of dressed, but he's still bleeding. I just love how he's like bleeding through his clothes. It's so weird. It's so creepy. What about anybody
when he's wearing
else?
The skin and he's got like, you can just tell there's like sort of a seam up the back, or like, yeah, I don't know, yeah. It's gross.
And I want to shout out the head. Yeah.
I want to shout out just kind of, I mean, watching it, it reminded me of watching a little bit in The Company of Wolves, which is an adaptation of like an Angela Carter story. And Angela Carter was a writer of the screenplay, and it just made me think about how you can tell when some movies are written by like literary writers, and like there's a sort of dreaminess or just like a willingness to play with form that I think other movies don't have. And like in the dream sequence, in the bit with the, like when she is in that hospital with the video of the flowers, that is so weird that it seems almost crazy that that hospital room is real, but actually that's the real place that she gets back to after her like trip into the hell corridor. I just think that Clive Barker's sensibility as a writer of fiction, of books, is evident in the movie, and that is such an interesting collision for me.
Yeah,
that makes it scarier. That's why I'm saying it now in the scariest movies.
Yeah, no, I think it's, you're definitely onto it. Like it's something about, you know, Hollywood trying to make a scary movie and trying to make it a little more literary versus bringing in someone who actually has that sort of mind and then having them try to adapt something that, you know, you would read that would be terrifying. But how do you capture that on, you know, film?
Yeah.
With $1 million.
With $1 million.
But man, I mean, I think there's just some really memorable. Like, I know a lot of people don't love like the creature down the hall in the hospital sequence. I think that's great. That scared the hell out of me as a kid. That scared the hell out of me as a kid. You can even, you know, now what? You can see the people operating it. It didn't matter to me. Mm-hmm. I just thought, wow, this is such a scary idea. What if this thing was chasing me down this hallway and the hallway seemed to never end? Like, I was more attuned to the idea that the film was trying to convey that I was so, yeah. I was forgiving of the stuff that didn't work because I was, I just thought it was such a brilliant idea. And you know, some people might say that's not enough to make a good movie, but I think it just works on weird levels. Any other scary moments that, that we're losing? I mean, come on. The Jesus wept moment.
So ugh. That's the shortest, line in the Bible is Jesus wept.
And also,
and everyone I think knows it because of this movie.
Yeah. And that was,
and I like the way he does it too. And like, cause it's, I'm trying to remember the context of it. It's Jesus being disappointed, but the way that he says it in this film, it's almost like I can endure this suffering, but Jesus can't. And that's just such a scary thought to a young Catholic boy.
Yeah. And, I love that that line was ad-libbed by Andrew Robinson. just threw it in there.
And it's probably one of the most memorable lines from the movie.
I agree. It's very much like Blade Runner. Yeah.
What line was ad-libbed there?
The whole, like,
the very last, the speech was there, but the last line, the all these moments that we lost in time, like Tears and Rain, was added by Rucker at the reading.
Ooh.
And I love in that, and to go on a tangent really quickly, I love in the documentary for that, Rucker Hauer says that. He says, you know, or the writer of it said, and then after Rucker said the line that he had added, he kind of looked at me like I've been a naughty boy. Like maybe I added something there. And obviously he was
a naughty boy anytime he wants.
Yeah, right. So yeah, no joke. But it was great because, you know, they kept it in. And then that's like, I mean, that speech is great, but that last line is brilliant, and I love that. And I love it when, especially here's someone who wanted so much control over this film because his last two movies, the script was just totally like obliterated and only three or four of his lines made it into the movie, that he was still willing to let someone ad-lib like at a crucial moment of the film. I think that just goes to show that like Clive Barker's not, he's willing to, you know, bring in things still if it makes the work better.
Well, you know what the original line was?
No, what was the original line?
It was literally just like, fuck you, or like, go fuck yourself.
Oh, fuck off, yeah, I think. Is what
fuck I love off, that too. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things. No, I think it was,
he goes, hey, Pinhead, suck it.
All right, well, yeah, that those are our scariest moments when actors ad-lib. And let's move on to a quick category called King's Dominion.
Oh, you done it now, Geordie Verrill. You monkhead.
This is a category where we talk about whether there are any ties to King. And there's a couple, and they're not huge ties. Did you guys pick up on anything, any kind of ties to King in this?
No, I thought we were going to say, there's none. Moving on.
Oh, yeah, there's practically none. The docuseries opens up with a quote from King where he says, I've seen the future of horror, and his name is Clive Barker. So he was held in high regard after, I think he read Books of Blood. And also in the commentary, we know that Mick Garris, who's done multiple King adaptations, he had, I think it was Sleepwalkers. I think Clive's in Sleepwalkers in the beginning. I think there's a bunch of reporters and photographers and policemen at the scene of a crime. And it's like all these like horror greats, all these directors and stuff. That is it. I don't know. Other than the fact that it's the horror genre, I don't know if there's any other ties to King. Dan, did you catch anything in there?
No, I was going to say that quote because I do remember seeing that. I think it's just he, you know, appreciates the whole interdimensional aspects of this horror. You know, birds of a feather gonna fly together. Doesn't have to be a direct connection, but you can tell Steven was loving this.
I will say that when Clive goes epic with his work, like I remember specifically reading The Great and Secret Show and thinking, this is very King-like. This reminds me of the enjoyment I get from reading a Stephen King epic. Especially like The Dark Tower. So, I mean, Mac, if you haven't read it, The Great and Secret Show, I think would be right up your alley.
Oh yeah. I'll write that down right now.
Yeah. And I've heard interviews too, where people talk about Clive when he doesn't have like a set budget or an executive producer that he kind of like he'll make his universe tremendous, way beyond what the budget can handle. And I think if you look at some of King's works, there is that artistic hubris of just like, well, I'm just going to blow it up as big as possible, right? It'll work because no one's going to stop me. And I think they maybe have some similarities there. Maybe they work sometimes better with a little bit of constraint.
Yeah. Hey, you know, they're both horror writers, so that's a connection.
Oh, there you go. Both born in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah, tons of connections.
Well, that was brief, but you know, I feel like we did our due diligence of that category, so we're gonna move on here now to a fan favorite called The Creep Show.
We gotta stop. The people are dead already. We gotta do. Christ, they died.
Hey, Dex. Hold it. What happened?
Two people are dead already.
Now this is where we get to have a little fun and say some of our favorite quotes from the film, or you know, dive into a quick reenactment of a scene. I feel like we have a scene here that Dan, you pulled up, right? Let's see if I've got here.
Correct.
And I think it's the scene where Kirsty first interacts with the Cenobites. And how long is this? Oh, okay.
It's kind of like, long.
Oh, it's like 10 pages long.
It's just 2 pages. That's 2 minutes.
Does anyone want to
be Cenobite?
You want to be a Cenobite?
Please. I've always wanted to do this.
Does it say if it's the female Cenobite talking? Oh,
yeah,
it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look, listen, unless you want to be Kirstie Mell and not the female Cenobite, I'll be Kirstie.
Okay. You do it.
All right.
Does that work? So this is where the cut to the scene. Kirstie's fiddling with the box, the lament configuration. It moves, and then
where the hell
bells
did
ring, chains clatter,
jumping in, yeah.
Smoke rises. Go, sorry.
And action. Where the hell did you come from?
The box. You opened it. We came.
It's just a puzzle box.
Oh, no. It is a means to summon us.
Who are you?
Explorers in the furthest regions of experience. Demons to some, angels to others.
It was a mistake. I didn't mean to open it. It was a mistake. You can go to hell.
We can't. Not alone.
You solved the box. We came. Now you must come with us. Taste our pleasures, please.
Go away. Leave me alone.
Oh, no tears, please. It's a waste of good suffering.
Wait.
No time for argument.
You did this before, right?
Many, many times.
To a man called Frank Cotton.
Oh, yes.
He escaped you.
Nobody escapes us.
He did. I've seen him. He's alive.
Suppose he had escaped us. What does that have to do with you?
I can lead you to him. And you can... It's falling apart. And you can take him back instead of me.
Perhaps we prefer you.
Hey, I feel like we should do our...
That was a good ending, Mel.
I feel like really we should do our own audio play of this. I liked both of your versions.
I liked how, Dan, you gave him a slight British accent.
I was all over the place.
Which makes sense.
It's like, you opened a freaking box. Now we're here, mate. In it, then.
Oh, no tears, please. Then? It's a waste of good suffering.
Jason Statham open that is box? News pinhead. I'm going to do it.
Oh, man. All right.
Taste our pleasures, love.
We've all got to do it.
So that's my favorite quote.
I want to let Mel start this off with a quote that we talked about earlier that everyone's got to do. Let's hear it.
Oh, do you mean come to daddy?
Yeah. Come to daddy. It's so creepy.
Oh, so creepy. Even now it's creepy.
Let's hear it.
It's sort of ahead of its time, right? Like, Hellraiser predicted the daddy craze, at least the more public daddy craze.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, ties back to S&M.
Some other... Oh, wait, Dan, you guys say it.
Come to daddy.
Now we're just going to get all the three of those on a loop, and then that's going to be like an hour that you can listen to on YouTube. We've already said Jesus Wept. I love the What's Your Pleasure, Sir? Bookend of the flick. And any other lines that jump out to y'all?
I mean, there's the classic, we'll tear your soul apart. That's a good one.
Absolutely.
Isn't that the tagline of the film?
Yeah. Brilliant. I also love...
I like when Pinhead... Oh, go ahead.
I love when that victim sees Frank and he's like, Jesus Christ, oh Christ, help me. It's so like overdone, but it's so believable.
The number of
like,
syllables
I believe
you
it.
Can fit into Jesus Christ directly correlates with how scared you are.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. Dan, what were you gonna say?
I like the where he's like, this isn't for your eyes. You can just imagine what's going on when, you know,
yeah,
they drag him back to hell.
Oh yeah, they're like, yeah. And then also they're like you're too young for this, sweetie. You can't.
And then we have such sights to show you.
Yeah, that's the other
one.
They're
almost excited about what they're gonna do forever to this person.
That reminds me so much of where we're going. You won't need eyes to see.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I think that's probably why I like Event Horizon so much, because I love the idea of Hellraiser, and it definitely skirts that. And I think that's why I liked that movie so much when it came out, because it definitely feels like a sister to this film.
Yeah, and the Lawrence Fishburne, I mean, spoilers if you haven't seen for the next 10 seconds, but the idea that he sacrifices himself to save the rest of the crew, even though it knows he's going to suffer forever in this dimension, but they won't have to. And like, would you make that decision?
No.
I would just be like,
not
man,
even
just kill
a
me.
Little bit.
I would have just killed myself.
Just misery enjoys company. Jeez, man, you didn't even think about it.
Eternal suffering.
Oh boy. All right. Well, I think that was fun. Those are some great quotes. There are also some more great quotes in part two. If y'all want to check that film out. But we're going to move on now to our overall thoughts.
You want to measure the bite marks, Henry? I guess he got his chance. I totally guess he did.
I can't do anything for you unless you stop being so goddamn elliptical. Now, just slow down. Tell me the whole story from the beginning. Can you do that?
So, with the crate episodes, it's not bright red Pennywise clown noses, but it's nails in the crate. Is it going to be one nail in the crate, or is it going to be five nails in the crate?
And
or,
five is good. We want to seal up the crate if we think it's
yes,
good.
Yes, yes. Okay. Seal it up and ship it off to other people so they can enjoy the crate. Or, and it just happens to work with this, nails in the head. Does anyone want to kick this off with their rating?
Go ahead. I was gonna say, why don't you go, Mac?
No. Yeah, Mac. You know what? Why don't you fucking go?
Hey, why don't you stop tossing?
Everyone's
it
turning
us.
On me. All right, Hellraiser. One of my favorite ideas, and what I mean is that I like love the idea of this franchise. I'm always intrigued and excited about a new Hellraiser film because I always think maybe this time they'll get it right. And looking back, I think there is something to be said about the first like six films. And I know we're only talking about the first one, but particularly the first. I think Hellraiser, in many ways to me, was not what I expected. It left me wanting more. Surprised me with the evil pair of lovers who in many ways scare me more than the Cenobites in this film. And I love the focus on pain and pleasure, the whole where one's paradise is another's hell. And I give this film five nails in the crate. You know, again, I saw this at such a a time in my life when I was coming to love horror, and it just delivered on every level. And I was so excited to delve into the rest of the series, which at the time, I think there were only four films. I think it was around the time four was probably coming out. Where you had like Pinhead in his MTV persona, like showing up at spring break and stuff like that.
Yeah, but, I remember that.
I was like, oh, I can watch this because it's like on during the day on MTV. There are things with the film that don't quite sit right with me, but you know, again, it was 1987, and I forgive it because I was so intrigued by the idea that it didn't matter. So yeah, five nails in the crate for me. What about you two?
I feel that this movie, I feel that if I try to put nails in the crate will like warp into a hypercube and not be a shape that is perceptible to human eyes. And like, it just doesn't feel like you can rate it alongside other films because of the context of its creation. Yeah. So if I'm forced to do it, I'm going to give it 3.5 nails in the crate because I'm being forced to like shape it into a solid that will exist in our dimension and judge it by the standards of other movies, and like that's what it gets. But just know that like the crate strains to defy traditional rating systems, given that this was made on a shoestring budget by a person who got his start writing literary horror. Like, it's just a weird dream that we all collectively had, and how do you rate a dream?
I love that rating. I think that's great. I think that's a great way of
that's perfect for the
of trying to make sense of this film, Dan.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear what I'm going to give it. But this was definitely one of the first horror movies that I had seen that kind of leveled me up, where I was like, wow, I didn't realize something could be this scary. You know, seeing it in the context of a kid, and I'm not a person that's big on nostalgia, but I'm sure there's something in me that still turns into a little boy when I watch this movie. I remember watching part four, I believe Bloodline. That was the first one I watched like as it came out.
Yeah.
I think it was maybe direct to video.
No, I think it came out in theaters.
I did it. I would never be allowed in that theater. I was too young, yeah. Just a baby. I think you said it, Mac, that it never fully answers your questions. It always leaves you wanting more. And a lot of other horror movies, they end up eventually explaining the entire mythology. And I still feel like there's mysteries to Pinhead, the Cenobites, Leviathan, the Puzzle Box, theologians of the Order of the Gash. There's just so much there. I think the creativity is amazing. The fact they pulled it in at $1 million, I give it five nails in the box.
Ooh, nice. We got two fires and a 3.5 nails in the something. really, really love Hellraiser. Love the series. Would love to continue to talk about the series, and that could happen if our Patreon turtle heads out there suggest it. But for now, I think this house has all but collapsed, and we've sent each demon back to hell, save for Butterball, who simply gets buried in the rubble. I always felt bad for Butter. I always thought. Wait, he doesn't go back to hell. He just gets buried in the rubble.
Like, he's not with his friends.
I know. I was like, where's that side movie where Butter's trying to find his friends? I just like to call him Butter now. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and continue to check out the many episodes we have here on our Patreon. And hope you look forward to our next episode where we'll be discussing the novel Rose Matter. But until then... Long days,
and pleasant nights.
Jesus wept. Ooh, that was good, Dan. It came out at the same time. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. But you know you want somebody.
This is the end of our show, for now. We hope you enjoyed this production. If you like our programming, consider searching for other bloody disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology coming to Prime Video on April 25th. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detective shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, premiering on April 25th.